The Man David by Brother Harry Tennant. Chapter 1. Whose going forth have been from of old. An old man was preparing to die. The burden of the years was about to slip from his shoulders, and he would be among the weary who were at rest in the quietness of the grave. But first he must speak to his children, the 12 boys, now all grown men. The divine spirit came upon him and gave him sight like the eagles and a vision of far-off things. One by one he blessed them, beginning at Reuben the firstborn and ending with Benjamin, the darling, the son of his old age. Strange things were said by Jacob there in the land of Egypt, some of which still wait for their fulfilment, like mountain tops ready to catch the first light of the morning. Each of the prophetic poems was memorable to the man to whom it was spoken. Each was a word of destiny, partly manifest and partly hidden in meaning. The fourth man to be blessed was Judah, whose name means praise. Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, till Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. This was something new. The promises to Abraham had made it plain that salvation would come through his seed, who would rule in the gate of his enemies. Through the words of the aged Jacob, more details added to the exceeding great and precious things of the gospel. The ruler would come from the tribe of Judah. He whose right it is, Shiloh, would issue from the house of praise. Jacob gathered his feet into bed and fell asleep, and the promise slept with him. Years passed by bringing bondage and oppression. Years came with wilderness wanderings, until finally the children of Abraham came to the banks of the Jordan, to that land in which their great forefather had been a stranger and pilgrim. Judah was long since dead, but his descendants were among those who marched 7 times around Jericho on the fateful 7th day, when, with the long blast on the ram's horn and the great shout of the people, the walls of the city fell down. She lay open and defenceless like an atoll in the path of a fearful typhoon. The citadel had been one of mighty wickedness, now brimful and ripe for the long, impending destruction of which God had spoken to Abraham. Nothing could save her. With the mighty shaking, the city walls collapsed, leaving but one place unharmed. A house upon the edge of destruction, with the scarlet thread in the window waving in the disturbed air. It was a removing of those things that are shaken, as of things that are made, that those things which cannot be shaken may remain. By faith the harlot Rahab perished not with them that believed not, having received the spies with peace. Thus the Gentile was spared from destruction to become linked with the destiny of God's people, and to be married into the family of Judah. One who was an alien from the commonwealth of Israel and a stranger from the covenants of promise, having no hope, found refuge by faith. She took her place in the inheritance which then was, and had hope of that which shall be when the line of the tribe of Judah appears in the land of promise. When the children of Israel made Canaan their home, the land was divided by lot. This had the double advantage of freeing the disposition from human preferences and contentions, whilst allowing the boundaries to be drawn according to the will of God. The lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. Proverbs 16, verse 33. It fell out that the boundary between Benjamin and Judah ran through the area which the holy city would occupy. A few miles southwest of Jerusalem, the little town of Bethlehem grew up on the hills, some 2,000 feet above sea level. Bethlehem, the house of bread, out of which David sprang, and in which the bread from heaven was born. Bethlehem, little among the thousands of Judah, is writ large in the divine history book. The tide of years ebbed and flowed, and with it the obedience and disobedience of the people of God. Milk and honey turned to famine, and the waywardness of Israel brought the judgment of God in the days of a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah. With his family, he left the house of Israel in search of food and came to rest in the land of Moab. There they lived for 10 fateful years, in which death took the man and his two sons. His wife, empty and desolate, turned her face with her two daughters-in-law to cross the Jordan and return to her homeland, for she had heard how that the Lord had visited his people in giving them bread. The three women set out, chastened by the years of bereavement, having nothing in common but the dead and the word which Naomi had tried to plant in the heart of her sons' wives. Despite her exile, despite her shattering loss, despite the wormwood and the gall of her life, call me not Naomi pleasant, call me Mara bitter, for the Almighty hath dealt very bitterly with me. She had made known the God of Israel to the two women of Moab. Naomi had nothing else to offer. And as the three of them stood with their backs to the purple hills and their faces westward toward Israel, she made it known that she could not hold out any hope of material gain if her daughters accompanied her over the river. The women wept. Sorrow is often the companion of choice and parting. They embraced and wept again. Time and again, the same choice in other guises has challenged two members of the same family and divided them. One shall be taken and the other left. It must be true today, if it is to be true tomorrow. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave unto her. And this was the moment of decision which placed the two women in different worlds. Orpah had caught the scent of Israel for a while and lost it. The call of home, the gods of Moab, turned her back. But Ruth, whose name means friendship, broke company with kith and kin, with home and country, and made the eternal and only worthwhile choice. In words which have the quality of a confession of faith and the love of true friendship, she remained with Naomi. Entreat me not to leave thee, or to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go, and whither thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. And so they two went until they came to Bethlehem. Moabites were forbidden access to the assembly of the Lord. Even to the 10th generation shall they not enter into the congregation of the Lord for ever. But God does not keep out of the house of true worship those who come to him in the right spirit. Neither race, nor colour, nor sex, nor status can keep out those who leave everything behind and humbly seek acceptance at the hand of God. Ruth was not bringing Moab into Israel. She was exchanging Moab for Israel. In true discipleship, she left father and mother and the land of her nativity and came to take refuge with the people which she knew not heretofore. She came into the land of Judah and was part of a memorable transaction of redemption, to which she submitted in humility and obedience. She married into the tribe of Judah to one Boaz. Now Boaz begat Obed, and Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David. Thus the long line from Abraham took root in Bethlehem. The stock of Jesse was planted, and out of it came David, who was a forerunner to him, called a shoot out of the stock of Jesse, a branch out of his roots. Both Jew and Gentile contributed to this line according to the flesh. Both Jew and Gentile were in need of redemption, and Jesus was partaker in their common nature. The time of David's birth was divinely chosen. Many circumstances worked together to make the time propitious. The dark ages of the judges had started to break up. Samson had begun to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines, those oppressors of the southwest coastal region, whose iron hand had deprived Israel of weapons of war and the means of making them. Hence, no doubt, the development of the stone and sling and the bow and arrow. The might of Samson was not matched by any spiritual reawakening, not until Samuel came and cleansed both the priesthood and the people, and cleansed both the priesthood and the people, did the real deliverance begin. The mighty force for good was then released in the land, a force which struck terror in the hearts of the wayward and reinstituted true values and the prescribed worship in the centre of the land. Samuel, last of the judges and first of the great line of prophets, broke up Israel's fallow ground and sowed the seeds of righteousness. The Lord was pleased to water it from heaven with a blessing which was to subdue the enemies of the land and prepare the way for the integration of the tribes of Israel. Samuel's great work tends to be overshadowed by the greater work of David, somewhat like the decreasing light of John the Baptist with the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ. But without Samuel's leadership and immense spiritual instruction, David's task would have been almost impossible. Moses had been neglected, the priesthood had become decadent and covetous, and the people did every man that which was right in his own eyes. Then, after hundreds of years of violence, lust, and national declension, the word of the Lord came to a young child. He symbolised a new Israel which was to be born through the tribulation of defeat by the Philistine signs and humiliation by the loss of the Ark of the Covenant. By this means, the old order was swept away and the ground prepared for a spiritual reawakening. If ye do return unto the Lord, and with all your hearts, and put away the strange gods and Ashtaroth from among you, and prepare your hearts unto the Lord, and serve him only. 1 Samuel 7 verse 3. Thus the prophet brought the people back to God. Thus the priest recircumcised the hearts of God's firstborn nation. The prophet-priest called them together to Mizpah, the watchtower, for confession and fasting. And there Samuel delivered to them the law of God and sounded out the great judgments of the Almighty. Chastened and willing, the assembled people listened to the prayer of one of the great intercessors of Scripture. As Samuel prayed, so the Philistines, taking a moment when Israel seemed to be off guard, drew near for a further onslaught. The people cried to the Lord for help, and he who was in the watchtower over Israel turned the enemy to flight. It was most fitting that as the Philistines closed in for the kill, Samuel took a sucking lamb, defenceless and dependent, like Israel, and offered it unto the Lord. From this restoration of the nation to God, there developed a sense of unity such as had not been experienced for generations. The 12 tribes from Dan to Beersheba were given an awareness of their wholeness and strength. And it's ironical that this sense of integration and nationhood gave birth to a desire for a visible king. Samuel, his life's energy spent in selfless service, was deeply grieved. The cold blast of thanklessness and the disrespect was bitter to his sensitive and aging soul. The new aspirations of the nation sprang from a deeper cause than disloyalty to a great man. The nation's faith had failed to see God in the watchtower. They wished to change the glory of the incorruptible God for the weakness of corruptible man. And this was the way to disaster for Israel as a nation. And should we fall into the same error for us as individuals? They have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. Thus Adam and Eve fell in the garden, and thus fell the Jewish nation in the day when they said, "We will not have this man to reign over us." When God is cast down from his throne, in our lives, sin enters in and has dominion.